Welcome to a special broadcast of the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. The Commonwealth Club is a nonpartisan public forum dedicated to airing diverse views on important topics of national interest. Today, Climate One at the Commonwealth Club presents a program from the Copenhagen Climate Conference. The first part of this program is a discussion with Arnold Schwarzenegger, Governor of California, and Wang Ming, founder and CEO of Himeen Solar. This program was recorded earlier today. The moderator is Greg Dalton, founder of Climate One.
We are here today from the United Nations climate negotiations in Copenhagen, where more than 100 world leaders are gathered to negotiate a global climate agreement. This program is presented with the Renewable Energy and Energy Efficiency Program, a nonprofit group based in Vienna. And we're broadcasting from a studio at Hub Culture in Copenhagen. First, we'll have two segments today. First, we welcome California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger and Wang Ming, founder and CEO of Himeen Solar, one of China's largest renewable energy companies. Later, to discuss the science and finance of climate change, we'll be joined by Rajendra Pachauri, chair of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and Kyle Koch-Wesser, vice chairman of Deutsche Bank. Please join me in welcoming Governor Schwarzenegger and Wang Ming. Welcome to Climate One, Governor.
Well, thank you. It's nice to talk to you again.
Good to see you in Europe instead of California.
That's right. Well, I like it actually here because I'm not the only one with an accent.
That's good.
It's nice to be here. You have an accent too.
Yeah. Chinese accent.
Yeah. Chinese He's pretending, accent. Oh, I'm not.
I have an accent. Here I have an accent.
You have an accent, exactly.
California accent. There's a lot of countries here in Copenhagen that have national policies on energy and climate. China certainly does. The UK has their low carbon transition plan. The United States does not really have a national energy and climate policy. President Obama comes here in 2 days with proposed cuts that are lower, not as aggressive as scientists would like and other countries have proposed. Can the U.S. really be a leader here without a national policy and with such modest proposals that they're bringing?
Well, first of all, I think that it is embarrassing that the United States does not have a policy. And I think it's also embarrassing that the United States not only has no policy, but that our policy fluctuates and changes all the time. I remember that during the 70s, we started going on the right track. In the late 70s under President Carter, where they talked about renewable energy and solar and geothermal and all the different things, give tax incentives to get people in that direction. And in the 80s, when the oil prices came down, all of a sudden that whole thing was thrown out and abandoned, and we had a different policy. So you can't do that. The Europeans were very smart that in the 70s they set themselves on a course for renewable energy and changing their policies. And now this is why most of the European countries now have 20% of renewables and having a lot of wind and solar and others and geothermal and so. So there's a lot of great things that have happened in the last 20 years in Europe, but not really in the United States. If you think about that, we have 2.8% of renewables in the United States. I mean, that is pitiful. And and we have an outdated grid system that delivers power around from one state to the next and throughout the country. And of course, the Obama administration now wants to change all that. But it will take a lot of effort and to figure out a way so that we have an energy policy that stays for decades to come. Because when you're in this business, you got to think 20, 30, 40 years ahead, not just what are you going to do the next 5 years. And that's what we have to do in the United States. And so with a great energy policy, then you also have a great environmental policy, because you cannot continue on creating your energy from coal or from fossil fuel. Those are the big polluters. We have to get off that. We have to find ways through technology how to create clean coal and how to rely more on wind and more on solar and do kind of what we do in California. The bottom line is that while we are not having a national policy on energy or on environmental issues, I think it's important that on a subnational level, that the states take on the responsibility and start creating this movement nationwide. And that's what we have done in California. We have taken on the leadership. We have started forming partnerships with other states and with other provinces north in Canada, and with states in Mexico, and with the Chinese provinces, and so on and so, and also with European nations. And that's the direction that we're going to go. We're not going to wait any longer for national governments to come up with, come to an agreement, or to have, for us to have a sound energy policy.
Are you applying any pressure, twisting any arms to try to get the U.S. to move a little faster here or back home?
I think that, like I said, the Obama administration wants to move faster. I think that they're interested in coming up with a good policy and with a good way of a good agreement internationally. But, of course, one person alone or one administration alone cannot do it. You need Congress to pass those laws. So no matter what President Obama is trying to do here in Copenhagen, he cannot make the ultimate promise or agreement because he needs Congress to verify it and to sign off on it. And so I think that, but at least, you know, he's leading the way. And so any help they need from us, we are more than happy to do that. But in the meantime, one should recognize that all great movements, and including the environmental movement, all great movements come from the grassroots level and do not come from any state capital or from any federal government or anything like this, no matter what movement you're talking about. And so I think that we should rely more on the cities and on the states and on the subnational level. We should rely more on those because they are the ones that really do the mitigation anyway. It's not going to be done in the capitals.
Huang Ming, 20 years ago, you were a petroleum engineer, and you, speaking of movements, you went out into the streets during the democracy protests of 1989. We've seen some of those protests here in Copenhagen, as well as the negotiations. So as a businessman and a former activist, what do you count as success here in Copenhagen?
In my opinion, there are three examples of successful promotion of renewable energy and other energy-saving products. One is just like Germany, they promote the feed-in law tariff. Mm-hmm. And the second is just like Arnold said about the subnational, like California, which is also very successful. A lot of big change and a lot of examples, just like high temperature thermal power plants in desert in California. And the third example is grassroots green revolution in China. The government only laid the foundation or platform for grassroots or private sectors to promote some kind of business like solar water heaters all over China. Nowadays, our whole industry of solar thermal industry have promoted 150 million square meters of solar heating systems. That's more than 50 million families, 200 million people use the solar water heaters. If USA reach such the whole population of USA have used the solar water heating system, every family, I think President Obama will gain another 4 or 5 Nobel Peace Prize. So that's the grassroots. My opinion is that we should push this kind of revolution, all level, governmental, sub-governmental, and grassroots, and all the sectors of the whole world. I mean, capital, industry, public, and also government, local government, media. Everybody should get involved in that. So that's a kind of fashion. Just like Arnold lead the fashion clothes, the hero of man, you lead the for maybe half a century of the fashion of the whole world. So next year and in the future, you will lead, all of us will lead the fashion of the whole world. Green fashion, energy savings fashion. So that's, I think that's the way out.
How much of your company has benefited from government subsidies? A lot of the debate in California and elsewhere is how much government should give money to companies or incentivize consumers to buy green products. How much of that has happened in your company?
First, we benefited from the open door policy. Just allow everybody to business, to open their business. So solar is one of the, that's the benefit from our government. Then we were successful. When we become successful in promotion, many, many families and many, many hotels to buy that without subsidy, then the local government gave us some support. For example, when we are successful, when we were successful in bidding for International Solar City Congress 2010, then government gave us some tax payback or some financial support for contract.
But you started without government handouts.
Without. But the central government and the local government did give some support in R&D, in reformation, innovation, in that level. So I think that's the promotion of commercialization from government is more important than the subsidized or intensive. Because without subsidies, just like Jimmy Carter time, when energy crisis happened, then government gave some subsidies to the industry, to the customers. Then when the crisis passed, then the subsidies was gone, the whole industry, the whole business is over. So many, many American people recall the good old days of Jimmy Carter times.
It's interesting that we have someone from a communist economy who grew his company without any government subsidy, and American companies are looking for subsidies to get going. We had several hundred people submit questions for this via Twitter, and Ralph writes, how much money lies in green technology and solar energy? Governor?
Well, we have seen when people have a fear that you have to choose between the economy or between the environment, we have seen that you can do both. You can protect the economy and also protect the environment at the same time. And we have, for instance, more than 60% of the venture capital in the United States comes to California, because we are basically catering to those businesses and we are also showing leadership. We have passed laws with AB 32, where we have made a commitment to roll back our greenhouse gases to the 1990 level, which is basically 25% reductions, with our green building initiatives, with our low carbon fuel standards, with our tailpipe emission standards, with us building the hydrogen highway, with us giving incentives for companies that build electric cars like Tesla, to go and, we help companies financially. And so it has been a huge boom in that area, even though the economy is really down right now worldwide. But in that particular area, in the green technology, we see a huge boom and increase in jobs. And also, like I said, in venture capital who come to California, more than 40% of all the patents in wind and solar is from California. So we see great, great activities and really leading the rest of the nation. And, we have great partnerships in solar, for instance, with China and, of course, Wong. I want to brag a little bit about him because he has been kind of like the solar king of China, and he has done an extraordinary job. So this is why it kind of annoys me a little bit when you come to this global climate summits, as this one is here in Copenhagen, and then people say, well, China hasn't made a commitment, or the United States hasn't made a commitment. Well, that's true. They maybe have not made a commitment on a national level and still have some difficulties to have some things need to be ironed out. But in the meantime, I think that the people also should understand that that does not mean the United States is not moving forward, because we on a subnational level, we are doing great things. And also the same is in China. There's more solar being installed in China. There's more electric cars being built right now than ever before. Their research and a battery and all in every different level, because I know the partnerships that we are forming and the kind of things that we are selling to China. So there's many different levels, but on a subnational level, is great, great action, and one should not discount that. And this is why I'm a big, big supporter of provinces in China and of states in the United States and in other places to come together and to have an international summit, just like they have here of the national governments, but on a subnational level. And so we push forward with the whole thing, and we have seen that the national government, when the states are successful, states always act as a laboratory for the federal government. And so when they see something working on the state level, then they adopt it and they copy it. And so we have seen that with the efficiency of cars, the laws that we have passed with the tailpipe emission standards, and the federal government has adopted the same kind of laws. Mm-hmm. And we hopefully they will also adopt the reduction in greenhouse gases, our AB32, which is a bill by Fran Parfley, that has been very successful, and we are now slowly implementing that in California.
You also this week announced something called the R20 with Canada, France, some other countries. Canada's been a country that's been more hesitant. They export a lot of dirty tar sand oil to the United States. Is part of your thinking there to sort of push the national government in Canada further along through the states?
To inspire them, that's the idea. But remember, France is a very unique place because they get, most of the energy is from nuclear power. Mm-hmm. So there is really no greenhouse gases. I mean, they are way ahead of us. When you look at the amount of greenhouse gases they emit as a country, it's very low compared to other countries because of that. I think it's like 80% or so, if I'm not mistaken, is from nuclear power. And we in the United States, and I in California, talk about the possibility also of looking at nuclear power, because we should not exclude that at all when we talk, about renewables and about getting off fossil fuel and getting off the dirty coal and so on. And that's why in the end I always say, what will save us all is not all of the agreements. What will save us really is technology. The agreements are great. To make agreements on a national level, to make agreements on a subnational level, and those. But one should not forget about the scientists, one should not forget about the universities, the research that is done on that level to find technology. Because remember, there's no one in the world that wouldn't rather buy a truck that is electric or a truck that is hydrogen than to buy a fossil fuel or some kind of a gasoline truck, if the technology is available and if the price can be competitive. Right now we still have a problem, even though the technology is moving very quickly. Mm-hmm. But still, when you buy a hybrid car, it costs you $10,000 more. Mm-hmm. Still, when you buy an electric car, it costs you more. So technology costs you something. As soon as we get into the situation as we have been in the last 10 years with cell phones, where all of a sudden the prices come down and where everyone buys in, the third world countries, people that have no money having cell phones and iPhones and all of those things, that's where the action is. And that's, I think, what we are trying to get at, is that it becomes so readily available that the prices come down of electric cars and hydrogen cars and hybrid cars and all those alternative fuel cars.
Arnold Schwarzenegger is governor of California. We're at Climate One in Copenhagen, and our other guest is Huang Ming, CEO of Humin Solar. Mr. Huang, you have a lot of 8,000 employees, I believe, a lot of engineers. Do you think that technology leadership is moving to China away from the United States?
I think in that case, we need cooperation. We have strong point on one side, you have strong point on one other side. So this cooperation is very necessary. So I have two proposal to Mr. Governor. First, when you talked about provincial level summit, I'd like to invite you to host. My Solar Valley want to host that kind of provincial level summit, because we have the largest and the first international solar and renewable energy conference center, which we have more than 500,000 square meters of solar and energy saving buildings, hotels, conference centers, museums, entertainment center, theme park, and so on, and R&D center. We have more than 2,000 R&D and engineering for solar thermal. So if this kind of provincial level summit is held in China, in Solar Valley, which is not very far from Beijing, 2 hours fast train. So, Mr. Governor, do you agree with me? I need your support from that. Second, I have a proposal. I want to set up my business in California, maybe some joint venture. I promise another commitment or promise within 8 years, we can promote 90% of the family and maybe 70% hotels, hospitals, schools with solar heating system. Because in USA now, solar thermal is much, much lag behind. Solar high temperature power plant, PV is okay. So we will meet this weak point. So we want to organize maybe some joint venture, if you're welcome.
First of all, you're absolutely correct. Partnerships is where the action is. We always love partnering with China. They've been terrific and they're so enthusiastic about renewable energy and, like you said, about solar. And we in California, we are big believers in solar and in geothermal. And for instance, we have energy companies like PG&E and Southern California Edison that have just made agreements with a majority of the warehouse owners in California, because as you know, we have a huge amount of warehouse space with tremendous amount of space on top of rooftops that are not being used to go, and they signed agreements to put solar on top of those rooftops. It doesn't cost anything to the warehouse owners. PG&E and Southern California Edison pays for that, and they now get this on the grid right from there. So that provides, right now the agreements that were signed is like for electricity equal to powering 300,000 homes, and this will increase now. So everyone is getting really creative. I see more and more universities now having solar on top of their parking lots, you know, that keeps the cars cool because there's solar on top, but also at the same time it creates energy.
The PV.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
But how about solar heating system? I have from...
Well, we don't need as much heating in California, except maybe in the winter. We need more cooling.
But so many family swimming pool now...
Oh, yeah, no, I didn't. For instance, in our house we have that. You're absolutely correct for the jacuzzi and for the swimming pool. And so we have a solar, you're absolutely right.
Now we're
we
getting somewhere.
We have a solar for that, for the heating. You're absolutely correct.
Wouldn't be a program about California. We didn't get hot tubs in there somehow. So another Twitter question from a person, Adrian Moore on Twitter. Are hybrids a quick fix, which are cheap and easy, or would hydrogen be a better way to propel automobiles in the future? Governor?
Well, I think that we should never pick winners. I think that if it is biofuel, or if it is electric cars, or if it is hybrid cars, or if it is hydrogen cars, I think that the people eventually, according to how fast the technology develops and how efficient those cars are, they will pick the winner. And we have seen now that people are very interested in electric cars, and that's why you see, you know, Tesla, for instance, being a huge hit out there, and other car manufacturers, Fisco, for instance, has just now developed a car, extraordinary looking sports car, four-door, and they're building that car, they're going to build that car also in California. And there is also trucks being developed and built, electric trucks that will haul 60,000 pounds, especially for the ports. And because of the technology that has been developed in all those different areas, if it is if it is electric, or if it is hybrid or hydrogen, we have seen a decrease of CO2 emissions in the ports in Los Angeles alone, they're around 70%, because that has really created a big problem for the last few decades. But now we are seeing a fast decrease in that, also again because of technology. But which one will ultimately win, I don't think that we can say that yet, and I'm not about to push one versus another.
But California has advocated hydrogen a little more aggressively. The U.S. kind of wanted to pull back on hydrogen. Chevron's pulled back on hydrogen, but California seemed to be a little more bullish on hydrogen than some other people.
Steve Chu, our Secretary of Energy, He's a very smart fellow and he's a great, great leader, but he happens not to believe in hydrogen. And that's the reason why. And I always have this argument with him because he's, by not supporting hydrogen, he's starting to pick winners. And I think that government should never do that. And I think that hydrogen is a great, great future. We have been kind of ahead of everyone else because we were the first state to build hydrogen fueling stations. Because too many, for too long, manufacturers, car manufacturers have been talking about why would we build a hydrogen-fueled car or powered car when there are no hydrogen fueling stations? So they always,
Chicken and the egg.
And so when I came into office, I said, okay, then let's go and work together with some of the oil companies and help have them help us build hydrogen fueling stations. And we as a state also put money in every year. And we now have hydrogen fueling stations all over the state of California that if you have a map and you know where the fueling stations are, you will never run out of fuel. We still need at least double the amount that what we have now.
Right.
So we're not there yet. But the bottom line is that you can now have hydrogen cars, and we have a lot of hydrogen cars in California because of that. So there is a huge explosion in a hydrogen car area because of the fueling stations, and we are very aggressively this next year continue building hydrogen fueling stations.
Arnold Schwarzenegger is governor of California. We're at Climate One in Copenhagen. I'm Greg Dalton, and we also have Huang Ming with us from Huming Solar. We have about 2 minutes left, and we have a question from the audience about the negotiations here have been very rough, very difficult. It's not clear how they will turn out, but what did you hope about a positive outcome here in Copenhagen? Huang?
I think the biggest outcome is the impact to the whole world, psychologically, fashionable, and also the air, the culture. So that's very important. Everybody pay attention to that. So everybody knows it's the future. So everybody want to involve that. Not only these green people, but also the other, the public, the all of the countries. That's laid the foundation of the commercialization of the subnational level booming of the industry, of the reformation, everything. That's very important. Whether or not the result will come, it's not so important.
So it's about culture and psychology as much as the policies that might come out of this, Governor?
I think that one should never discount the kind of great work that's going on internationally. Every country has some great, great leaders there that are doing extraordinary work. For instance, Wang in China, or Dr. Pachauri, who is going to be your next guest here, who has been talking about, you know, replacing kerosene lamps and paraffin lanterns to replace them with solar, for instance, for hundreds of millions of people. I mean, this is just spectacular kind of work that you know, one should acknowledge. So even though maybe India has not yet signed on to an international agreement, but there's great work already going on within India, and the same is in China, and the same. So the point I'm making is that the more often we get together in those kind of international meetings, the better it is, because the more we learn. Every single time I go to one of those meetings, I learn from different countries of what they do, new ideas they have. You sit there with the Brazilians and you talk about the rainforest and the complications and how to get rid of the problem of the deforestation, what kind of incentives they need, how do we help them and how do we partner. You learn from those things. So I think that those kind of gatherings are very important, even though maybe they don't end up always with the exact success that one set out to accomplish. I think the key thing is not only to rely on national governments, but also on subnational governments, and like I said, on the scientists, on the university community, on the private sector, and not to make it a political issue, because to me it makes no difference. I don't know what his political philosophy is. I don't know what Pujari's political philosophy is, but we all work together, we all have the same interests, we all want to march in the same direction, which is to get rid of the problem of global warming and come up with ways to fight that and overcome that and make this kind of be our big challenge for the future.
All right, we have to wrap it up there. Thank you for coming to Climate One in Copenhagen.
Thank you.
You are listening to a special broadcast of Climate One at the Commonwealth Club from the Climate Change Conference in Copenhagen, Denmark. We've just heard from California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger and Himeen Solar founder and CEO Wang Ming. We'll now hear from Rajendra Pachauri, chair of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and Kayo Koch-Vesser, vice chair of Deutsche Bank. They are talking with Climate One founder Greg Dalton.
A lot of numbers out there floating around, different percentage cuts in carbon, different targets. What do you think is the actual goal that we ought to be going toward, either in parts per million or percentages? What's the target scientifically?
You know, the target has to be set by value judgments. We provide the underlying science. It is for the world to decide whether they want the Maldives Islands or parts of Bangladesh to be submerged by sea level rise, or they feel that as long as those places go, doesn't matter, as long as we are safe, it's all right. By we, I mean countries that are essentially powerful and determined decisions at the international level. I think that's a value judgment. Now, I want to emphasize that even with the 2-degree increase in temperature, the impacts are certainly not going to be easy to handle. Just to give you one single number, with a 2-degree increase in temperature, sea level rise on account of thermal expansion alone will be between 0.4 to 1.4 meters. Now add to that the melting of the ice bodies across the globe. You might end up with sea level rise of 1 meter. Now does the world want that? Does the world accept it? That's not something which science will tell you. That's something which ethics, our concern for future generations, and the fact that we have a responsibility on our shoulders should decide. Science can only assist you in giving you assessments of what would happen with different temperature increases and what kinds of impacts we're likely to face.
NASA's James Hansen is out there with others saying 350 parts per million. Do you support 350?
Well, I had to make a statement which I think has been repeated in several places. I said that as chairman of the IPCC, I cannot say it should be 350 or 450, but as a human being, I certainly support 350. And I want to draw the distinction.
Dr. Rajendra Pachauri is chairman of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Mr. Koch-Vesser, 350, deep cuts, how are we going to pay for it? Where's the money going to come from? Public, private, how the capital flow is going to
be? Well, let me first say, and I totally agree with Governor Schwarzenegger, give us a carbon price, and the private sector will do the job. And the way Project Apollo drove IT revolution and global growth at a higher level for decades, the green economy and carbon prosperity will drive growth in the future. Coming out of this financial crisis, it's very important that we see who are the new drivers of growth. It will be the emerging market countries like India, Brazil, and China will grow much faster than the developed world. But there's another huge emerging market, so to speak, and that's the green economy. Now, these incentive systems, these taxes, the combination of cap and trade and taxes, have to be transparent, they have to be long-term, and they have to be reliable. They have to give you certainty. We, as major carbon traders at Deutsche Bank, are already hampered by the fact that we don't know what the system will be after 2012. These are policy-driven markets. Get the policies right, have on declining scale things like feed-in tariffs, declining scale, rational, not waste money, the private sector will do the job. The second point is, of course, what we do with the developing countries. When you look at the negotiations this week, they are not going far enough towards what I would subscribe to, the 350 to 450 ppm. So you need a mechanism to get back to the table and scale up the ambition in a review that happens earlier than anticipated. I think that's realistic for this week. Second, it's realistic to expect that developing countries submit their nationally appropriate mitigation action and low carbon growth plans to an international registry and MRV. That's reasonable.
MRV but being
monitoring, reporting, and verification. And third, that comes to finance, there is not enough money on the table. Leaders have to take more money in order to finance the incremental cost to developing countries.
You're talking political leaders and taxpayer money.
Well, yes, because for the developing countries, no, let me qualify. For the developing countries, a lot of stuff is actually on the left-hand side of the McKinsey cost curve. It pays for itself, if energy efficiency in buildings, etc. But then there's a big area on forestry, red, and others where they need money. However, I would argue, and that is not sufficiently discussed here this week, There are market-based solutions also to that. Out of 1 billion public money, you can make 5, 6, 7 billion in private money that flows. There's a pipeline of projects in renewables, for example, in the developing world waiting to be financed. Because of financial crisis and because the policy uncertainty prevails, they are not being financed. We have been working with McKinsey, Deutsche Bank, and others on a scheme that can easily be scaled up then, where you take a certain amount of public money, you take a first loss equity participation of public money to take the policy risk out of the equation, and then big amounts of private money will flow, maybe to the tune of 1 billion public money, 3 to 4 billion equity, and 5, 6, 7 billion debt financing. And the 65 to 70 billion we need annually between now and 2020 to finance incremental cost in the developing world can to a large extent also be financed that way. Carbon markets is the third element. We need to scale up and professionalize the existing carbon market, CDM. Make it sector and programmatic based, make it with the marketing board and the regulator a much more professional outfit. We are waiting now just in the approval process, often by far too long, when we originate projects in the developing world under the CDM system. With those measures, coming back to my point, I think the private sector will do the job.
You place a lot of faith in the private sector at a time when we've just seen some very significant market failures, and some people are reluctant to say the market will solve all problems. Markets do fail. Carbon markets could be the biggest commodity market ever in the world. A lot of people think they could be gamed. Fred Smith, the founder of FedEx, came to Commonwealth Club recently and said, carbon markets can be gamed, lobbied, etc. So I just want to challenge you a little bit on your faith in markets that will just solve all the problems.
That's why I said you need a tough regulator. We have learned a lot. That's a different conversation during the financial crisis. Mm-hmm. What has failed here? I see no reason that you cannot regulate them in a professional way that meets high standards. And I think many countries are now moving in that direction. We just had a request from the People's Bank of China to come as Deutsche Bank and present to them why we would see a carbon market that should be developed in China, for example. Mm-hmm. But you're absolutely right. We have to make damn sure that this is transparent, that this is reliable, this is credible, in order not to lack in the end the political support. But markets can do it.
No, I agree entirely with that. I mean, the basic fact that we took our eyes off the ball and we believe that markets without regulation
right.
can do what is expected of them was a piece of naive policy making. And let's face it, I mean, people will take advantage of the situation. They will throw ethics to the wind. They will throw morality to the winds. And I think that's why you need governments, you need regulatory bodies to see that there is no deviation from intent or policy. And I agree entirely with Kaya that, you know, that's what we need to do with the kind of money that's going to be spent in solving some of these problems.
Does there need to be any supranational regulatory body? These carbon markets, if we're talking about a global carbon market and it's regulated in each industry, who's overlooking sort of the cracks? There'll be arbitrage. Have you given any consideration to any sort of international body that looks at the markets at all?
The vision should clearly be that we have a global carbon price and we have a global carbon market. But obviously it would be naive to believe that's for tomorrow. That's long term. The important thing is, like in other parts of capital markets, financial, that we harmonize policies to an extent that this becomes possible in the long run. We will see, of course, regional cap and trade markets to start with. But again, we have to be very careful that there are not the wrong incentives then, for example, for border tariffs emerging, because there is not the same philosophy driving these policies. And that's a big act of leadership.
Tariffs on trade, you mean? Is that what you mean?
Yeah,
tariffs on
trade? In the U.S., that's a real risk that people might say, if others don't do the same things, we just slap a border tariff. I was just in Washington with the Bergstrom Institute. They're doing a lot of work for White House and others on the link between climate and trade policy. Mm-hmm. I think that's an area we have to sharply focus on to have the right answers.
So you favor not using trade as a tool or a weapon in putting a price on carbon, that trade ought to be put off the side?
Yeah, no, it will be lead to a ripple effect to consequences that are very dangerous for the world trade.
I think it will be very unhealthy for us to go in for something like that because, I mean, that can be misused in a variety of ways, and
sure.
you certainly don't want to do that, and it will also raise suspicions which are not at all required to meet this problem on a global scale.
Then how do you enforce compliance? I mean, one of the problems with Kyoto was there wasn't a lot of stick to enforce compliance. If you don't have trade as a stick, then how are countries going to be compelled to meet their target?
Well, there are some parallels in WTO, mm-hmm. which works quite well. It's not optimal, but it works. But you're absolutely right to put that question. I think that's also my concern. How, in the end, countries don't get away not meeting these commitment levels. But beyond name and shame and other mechanisms, ideally, eventually, again, you would have a regulator and a global system that can penalize as well as reward. But that's not realistic near term.
And I think we have to learn from Kyoto. Kyoto was a step forward, but we know that it was an imperfect step. And therefore, this time around, we have to learn from all that we should have done with something like Kyoto, and we must do now. So I think the time for us to look at all these aspects and to bring them into any kind of a new regime is now, and we should do that.
Could I agree with Governor Schwarzenegger also very much on the point he made on action at subnational level? I was just with the governor of São Paulo State in Brazil. They are now going ahead with very progressive climate legislation, and São Paulo is, of course, the locomotive of Brazil, economically speaking. You see that in many other parts of the world. California is an early example. Networks of mayors that introduce standards and the whole equation of how you get much more efficiency in buildings and so on is a very powerful instrument for learning from best practice and linking up. And in the end, again, I mean, putting some pressure on those who are not doing it. So I think he made a very valid point. Let's not just wait for the national level treaties to be signed. By the way, on that one, I really hope the next 2 days they don't become bogged down in deciding endlessly on which track to follow, the Kyoto Protocol, the other one. Let's put the legal character of the eventual agreement for a moment aside, agree on the three other points that I mentioned, and then return to the legalities of all that.
So agree on the substance and the process later.
Precisely.
Absolutely. I think the substance is absolutely crucial, and I really don't think we should get bogged down with the legality or the legal implications of what would happen. But so, may I also endorse what Governor Schwarzenegger said? I've now come around to the view, and I firmly believe, that the nation state by itself is not going to solve this problem. You certainly need grassroots movements, and particularly in democracies, unless you have that, you won't have policies bubbling up to the top by which governments or leaders will look beyond the next election. I think they must realize that all this is critical for them to win the next election. That, you know, the voters are going to demand this, that local government is going to demand this, state leadership is going to demand this, and therefore I think we really need to emphasize on the bottom of the pyramid and start building activities that essentially don't wait for leadership from the top, but that leadership from the top will follow from what happens at the grassroots level.
Rajendra Pachauri is chairman of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. We're at Climate One in Copenhagen. I'm Greg Dalton. Mr. Kofesser, vice chairman of Deutsche Bank, do you agree with that bottom-up idea that we ought
to have
rather than top-down?
Absolutely. It's not either-or, but obviously bottom-up will be very powerful and is very much in line with the philosophy of the private sector, obviously, to work bottom-up. Let's start also private sector projects without waiting for government. Deutsche Bank recently, together with Siemens, very large utilities in Germany, the solar producers, started a truly transformational project long term, which is to bring a large part of the electricity needs of Europe from the Sahara through concentrating solar power. A purely private sector initiative. Obviously, we'll have to look at the regulatory environment, cross-border feed-in tariffs and all the rest. But by 2050, we want to be in a situation where private sector finance, basically, we bring much of Europe's power needs from the Sahara. The technology exists in California, Cramer's Junction, since the 80s. Unfortunately, later driven out by cheap Alaskan oil, which was absurd what happened there. Secondly, the finance will be a huge challenge. We are talking potentially 100 gigawatts, 400 billion euros. But that's doable in the end. We are talking next 40 years. But the geopolitics will be interesting because you need, of course, for these North African countries to consider this a development proposition where they meet their own energy needs, where they export energy, and if it's such a development and climate proposition, it can be done. But again, my point is it started by the private sector. So this bottom-up approach, both by subnational entities of governance as well as by the private sector, is absolutely essential. Let's not wait.
And let's talk about, you mentioned geopolitics, let's talk about China. We haven't really talked, we talked about Europe and Africa here. You've spent a lot of time in China for the World Bank. How do they come into this? And what's, what do you think that China needs to do? To
Most really- fundamentally, China has understood, and then they are very able to deliver, that the climate issue is not only obviously a threat to the country, and you only have to look at air pollution, the rest, you know that, but more equally importantly, it is an enormous opportunity to leapfrog technology and to be a leader in technology and markets in the future. Electric cars, I believe, 20 years from now, will probably come more from Shanghai than Stuttgart or Detroit. By leapfrogging and investing in these technologies, they can do it. China also has a command and control structure. I worked for many years for the World Bank in China, which enables, for example, mayors of Dalian or Tianjin, and I've seen their projects, to introduce and enforce building standards, energy efficiency standards in the vast stock of urban capital in a more, in a faster, more effective way than we can. So China got the message. It's a question like in the other areas of shifting demand from exports to domestic consumption, a question of time. It will take time, obviously, in such a big country. But they're well on their way, and they have a vision.
But they're still putting money into coal plants, internal combustion factories. They're still putting money in the dirty way
they
while
have,
doing...
At the moment, they have no option, but they are very interested in CCS, obviously.
Carbon capture and sequestration.
We need to have CCS commercially viable. The Chinese understand that, too, by 2020. Otherwise, all our numbers don't add up, I believe, also for India and the U.S., but China is on its way. I don't know, Pachi, what I think.
Well, I think in India we already have a solar energy mission which envisages 20,000 megawatts of solar capacity being established in the next 11 years. And talking about the role of the private sector, my institute is involved in an initiative to promote two major solar thermal plants. One in the state of Gujarat, which is very forward-looking, and the other in Rajasthan. And these are going to be 3,000 to 5,000 megawatts each. Now, these things are happening without any global agreement because the people and the government of India are fully aware that we have to be part of the solution and that we have to promote a pattern of development which is sustainable. And relying only on fossil fuels, where the imports of these sources would increase beyond acceptability in India, is not the solution. It's not the answer. We have to go to a much greater extent in developing renewable sources of energy, and that's what we're trying to do. So, you know, I think much is happening. Of course, it's not enough, but I believe, as Mr. Cockwitz has said, I think not only would electric cars be manufactured out of developing countries, but also renewable energy equipment and devices, because I think the pendulum is shifting and swinging in the opposite direction, and this is bound to happen.
First time I rode an electric car actually was in India at your conference in February, and can't do that in America, but I did it in India in a remote.
Well, I have one of those cars now. I drive it myself, and it's a joy and a delight, I can tell you that.
They're zippy, aren't they?
They are. They're really nice, yeah.
India is also known for using the per capita metric as a way of measuring this. I'd like to get you to both comment on whether that is the right, a useful metric to use, or is that the way to look at it?
Well, you have to use all kinds of metrics, but I think it's important to look at the per capita emissions measure, because I'm afraid people in the developed world, and certainly in North America, don't know what it is to live in a poor society where 400 million people in India don't have access to electricity. So I think they must realize that a lot of the space that is available as global commons has already been occupied by the developed countries, and therefore you need this metric to be able to emphasize the differences that exist around the world. Of course, in the end, I think we all have to converge and come to something that's a common measure of emissions per capita, but that realization has to set in different parts of the world, particularly in those countries which are huge energy guzzlers. And I think the time has come for people to understand that.
I think carbon equity in the end will be, of course, be very important. And if the developed world reduces by 2050 by 80 or 90% its carbon emissions, we'll come to a certain level that we all have to adhere to. And according to my knowledge, it will be 3 tons roughly of per capita emissions that mankind can afford. So a huge task to bring down the US from 2022, Europe from 10 to 12. India, of course, is only at 2 or 3.
Less than two.
China is, I think, at 6 now already. But the other point is, of course, it would not be in India's interest, I believe, or China's interest, to first walk up the Himalaya, so to speak, in getting up to 8, 10, 12, 15 tons, and then with the rest of us tumble down the Himalaya again on the other side to get to the 3 tons mankind can afford. There are much smarter ways in India's best own interest for technology leadership and doing what Sapachauri just explained. So carbon equity is important. Angela Merkel, our chancellor in Germany, has actually with India and others raised this issue. Otherwise, we will not have peace in this world if you don't have equity.
Do you think that the developed countries owe a debt for their contribution to the carbon that's already?
Well, undoubtedly, and I think more than that, you also need to see that there are countries in the world that are going to be the worst victims of climate change, who need help for adaptation measures, and some of that will require fairly large investments. You'll need infrastructure that would help to insulate them from the impacts of climate change. So I think this, again, is an ethical question, and it involves considerations of equity, not just across this generation, but future generations as well. And I think the developed world must chew on this major challenge and realize that, you know, they have reached levels of prosperity by occupying the global commons, where now they must yield space and provide support to those who are nowhere near that level of prosperity and will never attain that level of prosperity, to at least be able to give them a decent standard of living. And climate change and its impacts are going to make it very difficult for them to be able to reach anything close to a decent standard of living. There's so much deprivation in the world, and it's really those communities which are the most deprived that are going to be the worst victims of climate change. So I think there is an ethical dimension to this whole thing, which we cannot ignore.
And that ethical dimension means that there's a debt or a cost that comes with creating the problem.
Absolutely.
And we have to pay that.
Absolutely, right.
We haven't talked yet about multilateral institutions. You spent a long time at the World Bank. I think international aid has, some people would say, a mixed record. So let's talk about international institutions and their role in addressing climate change, whether it's the World Bank or others. Do we need to create some new ones?
Well, let me first say that nobody's perfect. Many mistakes were made by the Bretton Woods institutions, but I strongly believe that the world would be a worse place if these many decades of work of the Bretton Woods had not happened. Just look, I was myself closely associated with that. The leading role the World Bank played, very much behind the scenes, as it should be, in the transformation of China. When the World Bank was invited by Deng Xiaoping to come in 1980, it was, in the views of Chinese officials, one of the most productive partnerships. And there are many, many other examples. And I'm very glad that the new American administration returns to multilateralism more than the predecessor government believed in. I say that because it has implications also for the climate space. I think we will need an institution or an institutional setup that strikes the right balance between what I call legitimacy and efficiency. And what I mean by that is, let's be frank, I'm not in the private sector. When I was in government, I was more circumspect in expressing that. But I think the UN system has failed us in many ways as a negotiating mechanism and to get results on the ground. That is not to deny that they're wonderful people, that much has also been done by the UN, but it certainly doesn't meet the needs of this world. And of course, not the UN proper just has to be blamed for it, but the international community and what it gave the UN by way of competence and powers. So that's the legitimacy side, if you want to have every country, one voice. I believe what we created, and I was somewhat involved when I was Deputy Finance Minister in the creation of the G20. I think the G20 succeeding the G7 or G8 is about the right compromise between legitimacy and efficiency. Because obviously with 20 finance ministers or heads of state now in the room, you can get more results and you can be more effective than if you have 190 or 192. And what does that mean for the climate debate? I really hope that we don't make the mistake that we leave it all to very cumbersome UN-type international procedures. Obviously you need COP, you need what we have. But let's be creative below that level. And let me mention one example, coming back to how you ratchet up, how you leverage up public money 6-7 times private money. If you now put this in the UN framework and create the institutions, the legalities around that, we will probably spend 2 or 3 years doing nothing else but setting the framework. I think we should start now. I mean, this should be up and running in 6 months to take a few billion, for example, of this fast start money and for projects that are waiting out there. I explained that and could be done. So how you do it then? I mean, one extreme would be to say, let's take just a few like-minded governments. Let's say the UK, Germany, I mentioned that for illustration, Singapore, Mexico, who would sponsor it politically. Those countries, perhaps a few others, come up with the 3 billion or whatever to have a first big demonstration project or fund or fund of funds for that purpose, have a decision-making process as a result that does not have to involve the whole boards of multilateral institutions, and then bring investors around the table, pension funds, ATP here in Denmark has already put 1 billion on the table. We could have investment banks and others coming in, and move very quickly with these schemes, because projects are out there. Now, of course, some will say that leaves the poorest countries out, and where is that equity? And that obviously has to be a concern. But the way the G20 increasingly has members speak for all members in their respective regions, India, South Asia, Brazil, or Mexico for the Latin Americans, they have to be presented that way. That's, of course, also what happens in the UN Security Council in another area. So where we drive that balance and how we go for speed now, because you cannot defy the laws of physics. I mean, if you don't get this done in the next years, we are lost. It's not a trade negotiation. This is against the law of physics. And I'm very, very worried that we're already late. We lost 20 very precious years. And I think history will tell us in the future. I hope it was not too late, but it was very, very late.
Thank you very much to Kyle Koch-Besser, Vice Chair of Deutsche Bank. Dr. Rajendra Pracharya is Chairman of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. This has been Climate One in Copenhagen. We presented this program with Renewable Energy and Energy Efficiency Program, a nonprofit based in Vienna. And we're fortunate to have this space here at Hub Culture in Copenhagen. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a special broadcast of Climate One at the Commonwealth Club, recorded earlier today at the Climate Change Conference in Copenhagen, Denmark. The Commonwealth Club is a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum dedicated to airing diverse viewpoints on important topics. Climate One is a leadership dialogue on energy, economy, and environment. It is a special initiative of the Commonwealth Club of California. If you'd like to join the Commonwealth Club or purchase a CD of this program, call 1-800-933-7548 or visit commonwealthclub.org. I'm Susie Rocho. Please join us again for another outstanding program from the Commonwealth Club of California, produced in association with KQED Public Radio.